everyone. It is November 4th, 2018. This is episode 168 of At Percussion Podcast. I'm Megan Arms, and with us today we have Ben Charles.
Hi, everybody.
We're a small crew today. We're flying as a duo. Casey is in Spain. Laurel is busy. We're kind of like all over the place right now in this crazy time of year right before PASIC. But we're very excited to have a special guest with us today. He is a solo and chamber artist at the peak of his powers. Championing new music at the highest level, he is the soloist of choice for many of today's foremost composers, and he performs regularly with the world's leading orchestras and conductors. He founded the Colin Curry Group in 2006 to perform the music of Steve Reich, and I have no idea how he keeps all of these concertos in his head. So please welcome to the show, Colin Curry.
Great to be here. How's it going, everyone?
Good, good. So you're joining us from London today, right?
That's right, yeah.
But you could be anywhere in the world, as your calendar shows. You are a pretty extensive traveler. What's kind of what have you been up to in the past few weeks, and what do you have kind of coming up in the next couple of months or so?
Yeah, well, I'm in London over this weekend, but this is a sort of realistic snapshot of what I'm doing. I'm between trips. So last week, I was performing a couple of different concertos. I was performing in Vilnius in Lithuania. I was performing at the Gaida Festival there. They were doing a focus on Julia Woolf. Mm-hmm. So I played her really terrific percussion concerto, which she wrote for me, mm-hmm. called Rise and Fly. Great piece. And then I was also performing in Zagreb with the Zagreb Philharmonic Orchestra. I was playing there. Percussion concerto by James McMillan there, Veni Veni Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. And then this week I'm off to Singapore with my group. We've got an all Steve Reich concert there and some other events. One thing at an art gallery, and I'll be giving a masterclass, etc., etc. So yeah, that's a little window into kind of accurate window into the kind of things I'm doing on a week to week basis. Yeah.
Very cool. Keeping busy for sure.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah.
Colin, I had a question based on a few of the pieces you just named. It seems like if we were to talk about solo percussion, especially concerto percussion with orchestras, there are really two names that come up, and it's your name and Evelyn Glennie's name, who is, of course, the great Scottish solo percussion artist that claims she has the world's first career as a solo percussionist. And obviously, I know there's quite a bit of crossover in your repertoire. You mentioned the James McMillan concerto, which I think was written for her. And I know I've seen her play the Jennifer Higdon percussion concerto, which was written for you. And it's funny to me that there seems to be so much shared common ground between you, but I've never heard of any sort of collaboration project between the two of you. It seems like a double concerto would be great.
It's waiting
so could
to
you
happen.
Tell us about your sort of your relationship with Evelyn? Obviously, she's, not quite a bit older than you, but she's the senior of the two of you. And how you sort of, I guess, have looked up to her career and modeled your career or not after hers.
Well, I think the business of being a concerto soloist was something that inspired me early on. And obviously, I do play several of the pieces that she premiered. I mean, notably, the first McMillan concerto, Veni, Veni, Emmanuel. I mean, James went on to write me a new concerto, the second percussion concerto, which I premiered in 2014. But another work you could list in that category is also the concerto by Christopher Rouse, Der gerettete Alberich, which I play quite widely. And also, more recently, I've been playing a little bit the John Coriolano concerto. So, yeah, she has created terrific pieces, and it's nice there's a bit of ebb and flow in that because she's also playing some of the ones that I've premiered. And, we, as percussion soloists, we all need new pieces and we all need works of enduring value. So anyone who's able to contribute to that and get hold of these composers, you know, the heavyweight composers, and get a concerto out of them is contributing significantly.
Yeah, I was going to ask you later about some of these composers you work with, but maybe now would be a good time. I mean, you've commissioned, I'm not sure if you've commissioned all of these, but I was seeing on your website your picture with all these composers after your performances, but people like Andrew Norman, Louis Andreessen, Askel Masson, Steve Mackey,
yeah.
And composers you mentioned like James McMillan and Christopher Rouse. Do you have like a favorite or a couple of favorite favorite memories or experiences of working with some of these composers?
Well, I mean, most of the names you mentioned there are indeed pieces that have been written for me.
Yeah.
And these are really my favorite they're all my favorites, if you can say that. I mean, I would hate to choose the premieres that I've given. They're very interesting. And also, it's an interesting moment for a piece. I mean, whatever happens to it thereafter, the first time is always a very sort of specific moment, and it tells you a lot about a piece and maybe how it's going to go in the future. But there are too many, absolutely way too many to list, especially in the concerto format. I mean, I've lost count myself, but now it's over 30 concertos, certainly, that I've premiered.
Wow.
And I'd keep absolutely, you know, the almost all of them. I mean, the one or two maybe that could perhaps let go, but it's been a good strike rate, and I could never pick a favorite. But some of the recent ones, you know, Elliot Carter, there was an amazing opportunity when he was able to complete the two controversies in the conversation. For me, it was one of his last pieces before he passed away. The Kalevi Aho concerto has become a very big piece and is now getting a lot of play, not just by myself. Andrew Norman, I'm playing his piece a lot personally. I'm playing that regularly now, especially in North America, because he's really caught fire there. Julia Wolf, Jennifer Higdon, Steve Mackey, Kurt Schwetzig, Simon Holt, Dave Marek, Joe Dedel, I don't know. Glaring omission, Mark Anthony Turnage. I mean, I lose track.
Yeah.
But it's a nice position to be in.
That's so
there's
great.
There's this great quote from Bill Mersch, and someone asked him, "What's your favorite concerto?" And he said, "The one I'm playing right now." Bill Mersch, I had a question. You mentioned Kalevi Aho, who, if anyone's not familiar, he has a mission. I think it's to write a concerto for every instrument. And I'm not just talking about violin, piano, cello. He has a concerto for theremin. Obviously, a percussion concerto is a very wide-ranging experience. And so it brings to, and you also mentioned Elliot Carter, who wrote one of his, you know, last works for you. And Bill Mersch has a great story about he actually wanted Lou Harrison to write a marimba solo for him. And at the time, it was during, I think, the Gulf War or something like that. And Harrison said that he was such a pacifist that he personally couldn't bring himself to compose when a conflict such as that was going on. And then he ended up passing away before he could actually be commissioned to write a work. So are there any composers that you wish, and that, I guess this is a loaded question, but are there any composers no longer with us that you wish you could have written or had write a percussion concerto for you?
Well, sure. I mean, it depends how far back I'm allowed to go. But I mean, I always reckon Bartok could have had a really significant solo work in him. I mean, the Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion remains one of the sort of strongest and most sort of robust works in the repertoire.
I actually saw you perform that a few years ago. Yeah.
Was that also in Miami?
A couple years later in Miami, yeah.
Yeah. And what else? Well, I think Stravinsky would have done a cracking marimba concerto. I mean, I like his violin concerto a lot. I can imagine something sort of light and vibrant and neoclassical working really well. So that would have been good. And, you know, who would turn down a concerto from Beethoven? Not me. And out of everyone who's alive today, you know, believe you me, if they've not written one already, you guarantee that I'm after them. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, not done yet.
Well, Casey left a couple questions for us to ask you, and one of those relates to this. I think can add something to the conversation. He asks, from your perspective, what is the next contribution composers could make to our performance practice and or literature canon? Is there something we need more of, or is there something maybe we need less of? What do you think?
I actually think that as percussionists, it would be nice to have some more very high quality and sort of deep and dignified works for multi-percussion. I find we're a little bit lacking in that zone. We have some masterpieces. I mean, everyone goes around playing Xenakis. You know, Rebond B especially gets played all the time. But we don't have so many heavyweights held up that you can hold up with that. Oh, and maybe also pieces that are practical as well. I mean, I'm a big fan of Per Norgaard's I Ching, but, you know, it's I could never tour that really because it's
huge.
I mean, I've seen the tuned gongs on your wall, Megan, but you know, to get them around on a tour would be
huge.
Difficult. So I'm actually doing a to that end, trying to address them. I try to address all these things really sooner or later. But this season, I'm doing a composition project at Royal Academy of Music. Not commissioning, but having the postgrad composers write a series of multi-percussion works, which are going to be premiered by the students there. And working closely with them, also in tandem with the composer on the faculty, Helen Grime, trying to pair up these composers with these students and get a new set of pieces, work with them very carefully. So just plugging away, I think... concerto repertoire is now extremely strong, I would say. Mm-hmm. The chamber repertoire has always been strong for many decades, you know, going back to work that I've already mentioned, perhaps as far as the Bartok. I'd like to have a little more variety in the solo marimba literature. I mean, for my tastes, you know, I'm sort of a little bit more experimental and quite drawn to, you know, sort of modernity in music. So some more marimba music with a bit more of a sting in the tail would certainly tickle my fancy.
Cool.
So there you go. I don't know if that helps.
yeah. Well, you mentioned Helen Grimes. I was going to ask you, I had a note to ask you about her. I noticed she's written a concerto for you. She's a Scottish composer.
Yeah, just finished it. Yeah.
So what's that like? It looks like you're touring that in the upcoming
months. Helen Grimes is really one of the great composers of our day. I mean, she's a profound musical thinker. It's music of extreme depth and great beauty. It's very melodic music. It can be quite dissonant, but it's terrific sort of dramatic harmonies and superb orchestration. I mean, this concerto is going to be one of the most powerful pieces yet. The world premiere is soon. I'm just starting work on the solo part this week. Mm-hmm. And a lovely combination of things, quite a lot of resonance. There's some metal set up with vibraphone, crotales, glockenspiel, some tuned cowbells, you know, very ringing and clangorous sonorities. Some lovely solo marimba writing and a whole central section with a multi-set up that we sort of worked on together a little bit in its design and et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the US premiere is shortly after that. We'll be with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, which is probably the US orchestra with whom I've played, you know, the most of my repertoire. I mean, many, many, many contributors there and at least two or three premieres. So looking forward to being back with them. It's an excellent orchestra.
Very cool. Yeah, I can't wait to hear it. Sounds awesome.
Yeah, it really will be good. If you're interested in anyone listening to this who would be interested to hear Helen's music, you should check out an orchestral piece of hers called Near Midnight.
Okay.
And you can hear that on Spotify and some other channels. But, I mean, that'll give you a little window into her language. Huge fan. And we're all very lucky that we now have percussion concerto from her. That's big news.
That's awesome. Very cool. Well, while we're talking about composers, Ben, would you like to share your topic with us?
Sure. So I guess I mentioned this before we started recording, but a few years ago when I was a student at University of Miami, the Cleveland Orchestra that has a residency in Miami came and performed, and they performed the Jennifer Hayden Percussion Concerto, and Colin was actually playing the solo part for that, and this work was written for him. So I figured what better day to talk about Jennifer Hayden. And actually on Jennifer Higdon's episode, which is one of the great tragedies of this podcast, that we actually lost that episode. my topic for that episode was Colin Curry, so I figured we'd trade even though no one heard that segment. So anyway, a little bit of biographical information about Jennifer Hayden. She was born December 31st, 1962 in Brooklyn, New York. She grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and Seymour, Tennessee, and her father was a painter who was particularly interested in exposing his children to many different types of art. In spite of this, though, Jennifer actually was not exposed to much classical music growing up. She said that most of her musical experience came from listening to rock music and folk music of the 1960s. She joined concert band in high school at the age of, I think, 15, and she started out playing percussion, but she soon taught herself to play flute. Once she graduated high school, she attended Bowling Green State University, where she studied with Judith Bentley. She studied flute, I should be specific, with Judith Bentley. And her teacher actually encouraged her to try out composition. She actually said that she had some teachers that sort of, it sounds like, discouraged her musical studies as a whole because she had started so late and she was so behind. She said she actually had to basically start musical training from scratch in college. She had no basic music theory skills, including how to spell a chord or what intervals were. And she said she had no keyboard skills either, so she had quite a bit of catching up to do. While she was a student at Bowling Green, she met Robert Spano, who would actually become a champion of her music later in life. And she went on, after graduating from Bowling Green, to earn an artist diploma from Curtis, which is quite impressive considering she had just started composition, I think, at the age of 21 or something like that. And while she was a student at Curtis, interestingly, she taught Hilary Hahn. I'm assuming she taught Hilary Hahn, like, as a music theory TA or something like that, because obviously I don't think Jennifer Higdon was teaching violin.
Right.
After that, she attended University of Pennsylvania, where she earned her master's degree and doctorate under the tutelage of George Crumb. Now she teaches at Curtis, and she served as the composer in residence at the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, Green Bay Symphony Orchestra, Philadelphia Orchestra, and Fort Worth Symphony. Of note, Jennifer Higdon is openly gay. She lives with her wife, Cheryl Lawson, and they run together Lawden Press, which is the exclusive publishing company for all of Jennifer Higdon's works. She's received awards from the Guggenheim Foundation, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, two Grammy Awards, including one we're going to talk about in a minute, the Pulitzer Prize, and many other awards. And one of her frequent collaborators has been the great conductor Maren Alsop, of course, of the Baltimore Symphony that we mentioned earlier. And there's this great, great quote from Maren Alsop. This is actually about Jennifer's percussion concerto, but I think it can apply to pretty much all of her works. Maren remarks, "Accessible is often a dirty word in the world of art, but Jennifer embraces the concept and explains that a major priority for her is to give her listeners a sense of grounding and a feel for where they are in her compositions. She is far less concerned with formality and technique than she is with the final test of a piece, how it sounds." So I think that's a great way of summing her music up. And I just wanted to kind of quickly tick off all of her percussion works here. She has three works for chamber percussion, one for solo, and then one concerto. So in order, by the year they were written, excluding her concerto, which we'll talk about last, in 1991, she wrote a piece. She was commissioned by the Network for New Music called Zones. It's for percussion quartet and CD. And on her website, she lists two different scorings of it, but I couldn't figure out what the difference was in the scorings. There wasn't an explanation that I could find anywhere online. But basically, this piece is for, like I said, percussion quartet and CD, and it deals with various reactions that people have to war. Specifically, the piece is based around the Vietnam War, and she says she uses drums in this piece because of their historical association with war. In 2006, she wrote a piece called Splendid Wood for Marimba Ensemble. It's for three marimbas with six players, and it's a celebration of the splendor of the marimba, she says. It was commissioned by Bradford and Dorothea Endicott for Frank Epstein and the New England Conservatory Percussion Ensemble. The Endicotts, from my understanding, basically they are a wealthy couple, and they asked Frank Epstein, if you had a lot of money, what would you do? And he said, I would commission works for percussion ensemble. So they've commissioned quite a few. She has a piece from 2012 called Light Clockwork for Percussion Ensemble. It's for 12 players. It was commissioned by Donald and Maya Farish for Dean Witten and the Rowan University Percussion Ensemble to commemorate 30 years of Dean Witten's teaching at Rowan. And it was written with the idea of passing time in mind, where the players move along to different keyboard percussion instruments to represent, I guess, moving through time. There's a clip of it on her website. It's a beautiful sounding piece. In fact, I'm kind of surprised I've never heard of it because it sounded really, really good. So I'd like to check that out more. And then in 2015, she wrote a piece called The Grace of Presence for Solo Vibraphone. It's about a 4-minute, one movement work, and it was dedicated to Evelyn Glennie. There was no recording of that work on her website or anywhere that I could find online. So I'm very curious to hear it. And then last but not least, the big bad wolf here is her percussion concerto from 2010. It's one continuous movement, about 25 minutes in length. It was commissioned by the Philadelphia Orchestra, Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, with contributions from the Philadelphia Music Project and the Lacey Foundation of LDI. It was written for and dedicated to Colin Curry. It won one of Jennifer's two Grammy Awards. This one was 2010 for Best classical contemporary composition. It begins with a soft rolled marimba part because of Jennifer, as she said, Collins' fondness for the instrument. There's one lyrical section that includes a portion where the soloist has to bow the vibraphone and play with mallets simultaneously. I think this part also has quite a few nods to George Crumb, including Crotales placed on timpani. There's an extensive percussion cadenza that begins with a completely improvised solo, which Colin has a clip of his version of this on YouTube. And then there's also, to conclude the cadenza in this piece, there's this great sort of duel between the soloist and the percussion section, and in particular the timpanist gets quite the highlight. I got to play the timpani part with Svet Stoyanov when we did it when I was a student at Miami, so that was fun. The piece has been widely performed the world over, including performances by the London Philharmonic under Marin Alsop, the Cleveland Orchestra, and the Philadelphia Orchestra, and it's been championed by some of the world's leading percussion soloists, including Colin Curry, Evelyn Glennie, whom I also saw perform the work, Svet Stoyanov, and then one of the exciting new soloist performing this work is Cameron Leach, who is one of Michael Burrett's students fresh out of Eastman. So, Colin, could you tell us a bit about your background with this piece and the conception of it and how your performances have evolved throughout time?
Yeah, sure thing. Well, this was a big piece for me. I was very taken by Jennifer's music. I heard it live in London, the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Performed her concerto for orchestra, and then we'd set up a meeting, so we sat down, we always talk about it fondly, we sat down and we had tea, which she thought was quite amusing, kind of British, but we had this very good chat, and we got to know each other, and we found out that we had a lot of things, sort of sensibilities in common, and we spoke about how a concerto could work, and I told her then how much I liked her orchestration, and how her colours could really support a percussion solo very well, and so we discussed maybe that it would be a piece that would, as well as having the winds, strings and brass, would also have large parts for piano and harp, so a lot of concertante groupings available there, and indeed that's what happens in the piece, as well as a large focus on back and forth between the soloist and three percussionists in the percussion section and a large role for the timpanist. So I think that's the thing that faces composers when they're doing a percussion concerto, and it comes up a lot when I talk to them first, is, am I going to have any percussion in the orchestra? And I think it's usually all or nothing. Either you really make something of this and you have a lot of call and response or unisons or real teamwork going on, or you have nothing at all. And this is definitely an all-in kind of piece for that. I mean, there's big roles and really kind of fun and exciting and kind of famous roles now for the percussionist in the orchestra. Sensational piece. I mean, it was an extremely exciting set of premieres because I gave the world a small correction for you, actually. It was premiered in 2005 we had an incredible run of premieres. I can hardly believe it now to say it, but I gave no fewer than 7 concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Which was 5 concerts in Philadelphia, concert in the Kennedy Center in D.C., and last but not least, Carnegie Hall. So it got a humdinger of a real rocket-propelled premiere that was no one could really ignore if you're paying attention to that kind of thing. And kid you not, for the first 5 or 6 years of that piece's life, I was playing on average every year at least once a month, so this thing just went bananas. I've played it 80-90 times.
Wow.
So it really, really was sort of huge, and I think fantastically appealing to the audience for sure. Just really colorful, lots of variety. Very tender-hearted. I mean, some lovely. My favorite bits are probably not the fireworks, actually. There's plenty of that. But the lovely slow music, very beautifully worked out, and also it's very good duration. I mean, the piece is not over long, and it's lovely proportions, and always something going
moves,
on.
And,
it's always on the move, and it's rocking. Really good one.
That's awesome. Well, I'm sure that being able to play that many performances of this concerto and, playing in Philly that many times didn't happen overnight. And we have a couple of questions on Facebook from people who are kind of curious, I guess, of how you got where you are and just some experience since you've done so well in this genre, and there's so few people that are doing that. So I'll start maybe with actually another question from Casey, which is, for our young listeners who dream of performance careers like yours, what are some steps they might take to boost their chance of bookings? Can you give any starting advice sort of like about the business side of things?
Well, I mean, it's a tricky one, this. I mean, I wish I could give you all the keys to whatever kind of career you want to have as a young player. But of course, the music business is very tough and very fickle. But in my experience, if there is someone who genuinely really does have something to say, it will, the music business in a positive way does seem to allow that to happen. And, you know, I've been really encouraged by young players coming through in particularly actually in the last few years. We've seen some really exciting things emerging. Mm-hmm. You've got to know what you like. I mean, I'm very sort of, I mean, I would even say, happily say that I'm very opinionated. So I definitely know the music I like, and mm-hmm. I'm sure as anything, know the music I don't like and uh-huh. things that I will never do. Uh-huh. So I've certainly made no concessions to any kind of gags or sort of. I remember once I was asked by quite a high powered man in the music business. He was an agent, and he said to me, "How interested are you in show business?" And I just looked him in the eye, and I said, "Not at all." And that was the end of the conversation. No. So you know, but then that's just me. And I have said to fledgling soloists before, you know, if you want to be noticed by an orchestra and actually asked to do this, you'll have to do one or probably both of two things. But either, certainly, you'll have to play the existing repertoire as well as or better than anyone else, mm-hmm. or find a way to create your own repertoire and get an original voice. Now, the latter is probably preferable because of that sort of creates more repertoire for posterity. But, you know, if you are going to take on these pieces that have been played by a lot of people, I mean, you'll be compared mm-hmm. to the benchmark performances that have already been given.
Right.
So you're going to have to be pretty on point.
Yeah.
But I think people find a way. The career of a percussion soloist could be changing, and, you know, it changes so sort of gradually that it's hard to notice because it's so incremental, the changes as they go. An itinerant soloist such as myself, who's playing with a dozen or a couple of dozen orchestras a year all around the world, I mean, that kind of career could actually be perhaps less possible these days because there are more percussionists everywhere.
Right.
So, you know, some of the first gigs I got when I was a teenager, I was asked to go and play certain concertos in certain places because at that time there wasn't really anyone around to play that piece then and there. But those opportunities probably wouldn't be around anymore for a Scottish teenager who happened to be, you know, okay at sort of percussion, but, you know, not quite there yet.
Right.
Because percussion has just exploded. The standard is phenomenal, you know, worldwide. So, repertoire. Find the good composers, whoever mm-hmm. they may be. You know, with luck, some of your peers might be able to help. You know, two of the closest collaborators that I've maintained were Joe Dedell and Dave Marrick, and mm-hmm. they've written many, many pieces for me over a couple of decades or more, and they still are writing music for me. So if you're lucky enough to meet people like that early on, you keep them close.
Right.
I had a question based on what you were just talking about. When you said when you were a teenager, you started sort of getting asked to play some percussion concertos, basically because you were the only one that did. And I noticed on your website, one of your works is, I think, a piece that is sort of tragically unknown amongst younger players. And I discovered it via an Evelyn Glennie recording. And that's the Mio, I can't remember the exact French title, but basically the Mio percussion concerto for soloists with small orchestra.
Yeah.
And petite orchestra.
Yeah.
Was that one of those works? Yeah. And even if it wasn't, could you tell us about playing that piece? Because I've never played it. I've never seen anyone play it live. And it's like, I think it's just such a great piece.
So the Mio, this probably is the first percussion concerto written in, I believe, 1939, or certainly, let's say, late 30s.
Okay.
And it's the Concerto pour Batterie et Petit Orchestre. And the batterie in question is a very lovely sort of fledgling multi-percussion setup. There's a set of timps, there's some other drums, a woodblock, a triangle, a tambourine, this kind of thing. Your staple sort of basically soldier's tale with timps kind of setup.
Mm-hmm.
But of course it's Mio, so you know that's a serious composer. So of course, if you're a percussionist, you should be paying attention to that. And it's a lovely piece with a fascinating structure. It's rather short, which I think is another reason it's not done very often, because it's under 10 minutes as a piece. I think it's only about 8 minutes, 8 or 9 minutes, let's say. I performed it once, and I love doing it. It's got some beautiful moments, and it's got lovely solos for the wind, muted trumpet solo, clarinet solo, I remember very well, very beautiful. Percussion part is what you might expect from that time. It's rather rudimentary. I think the good soloist of today would sight read it no problem at all. I think there's only a couple of tricky licks in it, only a couple of bars long. And I played it once because I wanted to have a concert in which I was giving a massive world premiere by Joey Raukens, who's a phenomenal Dutch composer who wrote me a brilliant concerto that premiered in 2011. And I thought it'd be interesting to have a concert in which there is not only the world's newest percussion concerto, which is obviously Joey's premiered that day, but also the oldest.
That's so cool.
So the concert, the concert was Mio Concerto pour Batterie Petit Orchestre, Stravinsky Dumbarton Oaks, interval, Joey Raukens premiere.
Cool.
And that was a really memorable event, and nice to sort of trace where things have gone a little bit.
Uh-huh.
The Mio is a lovely piece, but I think it's a slightly strange piece. The structure, the first section, the first couple minutes are kind of fast, and then the rest of the piece is slow. So it's odd, but very, very interesting, compelling piece.
Huh. Yeah, the beginning, it's just this great rhythmic statement, but it's like one complaint that everyone has about the piece is like, what happens at the end? It just fizzles out.
Yeah. Well, another thing I'd like to mention is that another reason that it's an important piece, and it shows that how influential these things can be. For many years, I spoke to Louis Andriessen about a concertante work, and he agreed in principle, but he said he didn't have an idea. You know, he's usually an ideas man. He's not writing a lot of abstract music. There's normally something, a story or a impetus, something behind a piece. And he heard the Mio, and he loves it. He rates it very, very highly. He thinks it's an excellent piece. And he loved this weird structure where something, it sort of feels like it goes wrong for the soloist. Things kind of melt down. So there's quite a lot of vibrancy at the top, and then things just kind of go gradually, gradually more and more dark and desperate and end kind of tragically. And the piece he ended up writing me, Tap Dance, which I premiered in 2014, is very definitely inspired by the Mio and has a similar, not identical, but a similar structure, and certainly this idea of kind of false promise, a very strong start that fizzles out rather quickly and then becomes kind of grave.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. I had no idea that's awesome. So there's a couple more questions that's sort of about being a percussion soloist, and one is from Will Marinelli. He asks, how can percussionists get past any possible reservations they may have about being a soloist?
Well, I think if you want to be a soloist, you cannot have reservations. It doesn't go with the territory. You have to get on, if you're going to take the stage, that's a reservation-free zone. But of course, I understand the question. You know, that's not really answering the question. The question is more to do with, you know, would be a risky business, and you know, to dare to take that kind of risk, to commit yourself to such a thing when the competition is so high. Of course, yeah, it must feel rather daunting. But I don't know. In my own case, I simply I simply had to. And I think if you have that feeling within you that I just have to do this. I can do no other thing. And for me, I had no idea. I had no idea at all what was going to happen in my career. That I could perhaps do it was highly questionable. But still, I couldn't resist.
Yeah.
But careers work in the following way, I think, as well. They happen. It's you lay down the tracks in front of you. You're on this train. You're going along. And you just put the tracks down in front of you as you're going. I mean, you really have to. And I'm still doing that. I mean, I don't really know what I'll be doing. I mean, three, four years from now, there's sort of just vague plans. So there's a lot of hoping for the best. But keep your back up. Make sure you're playing well and that you're playing music you believe in, and that you're prepared for your concerts.
Yes.
Yeah. That's essential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of playing and keeping, being prepared, Crystal Michael asks, what are you doing practice-wise to keep your chops up?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I sort of jump from like Tarzan, I grab pieces and then play them, then swing to the next one, and then sort of... There's a lot of sort of slightly worrying time in midair, and that's what I'm practicing, jumping from one piece to another. And, yeah, I mean, I have to be very economical in my practice. I mean, I frequently learn a new concerto on just a few days' practice. And I would revise. I mean, I've got a lot of pieces in the repertoire that would get revised on probably just a few hours of practice now.
Uh-huh.
So that's taken... a lot of organization and a lot of stress to be able to get to that stage. Certainly, I never used to be about that, and that's something that I've learned over the years is how to practice and also what exactly to practice.
Right.
But keeping in shape for the just general technique, I'm lucky that way in that I'm always kept on my toes. I'm playing pieces, most weeks of the year, and having to change repertoire. I mean, this year alone, I've done the solo recital, I've done Stockhausen Contacta, Czernich Concerto, Andrew Norman Concerto. I can no longer possibly recall all the pieces I played this year, or let alone maybe even this autumn. I've done my new CD with Håkon Hardenberger, a whole disc of repertoire for trumpet and percussion.
Uh-huh.
So that I think that keeps me strong and keeps me slightly mad.
Yeah.
But I enjoy it.
Good. And then just one more kind of along those same lines. Sorry, Ben. from Chris Seitz, he asks, how does one acquire such percussive superpowers? Which you kind of just, it's pretty apparent by the rest of our conversation. But here's something more specific. As someone who's traveling so much, what's your diet on the road like? And how do you stay healthy while you're traveling?
That's tricky, actually. I mean, and also as I sort of get a little bit, certainly up the hill, if not, I hope not over it yet. But, it's tricky. Yeah, travel day, these days, which I have many of when I'm coming to North America. I mean, it's a long travel day. And, you get stuck in the airport, the food options may be a little limited, maybe start to... The dark side, tempts you to some, dodgy burger somewhere or pizza, something that, feels like a tempting idea at the time, but this boy doesn't feel very good the next day.
Right.
It depends where you are. When you're in a city, I had a lovely week in Boston, for example, recently, and, that was no problem because it was just very healthy, lovely options around. And that's improved, actually, over the years. That has got a little bit easier. But round about the concerts, I find difficult because I don't like to play hungry, but nor do I. I could never have a meal before I play, so I sort of have a big lunch maybe, and then resting in the afternoon, and then I go in for my pretty much warm up and start to get hungry. So I have to have chocolate, bananas, fruit, grapes, maybe,
and
then afterwards it's very difficult to wind down. So I normally do that going out for dinner, and has happened that you have a few drinks as well.
Yeah.
And that's just, that's it. It's fun. You enjoy it. And you know, trying to keep fit on the road is also doable, but you've got to be disciplined and you've got to be organized. So, yeah, it's a challenge, but it's an important question that's raised, actually. I think staying well, staying fit, staying healthy is essential to keeping your head in the right place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Beatles have a song called Savoy Truffle, and it was inspired by, in the 60s for a period, Eric Clapton, I think, only ate chocolate and did cocaine. That was his diet.
everyone finds their
probably
way.
Probably not super healthy.
Yeah.
on an unrelated note, I wanted to ask about a couple of other projects, because I came to Colin's work, and I think many of us did, through the sort of concerto aspects of it,
right.
But also a formidable chamber musician. And I know in
right.
particular you have your ensemble that, as far as I know, exclusively performs the works of Steve Reich, and then you also have your trumpet and marimba duo.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about those projects?
Yeah, well, first of all, the group is very dear to my heart. This is something that just, again, it's one of those things that just had to happen. I'm surrounded here in the UK by the most brilliant percussionists that I get on also really well with. I mean, we're actually quite a diverse bunch. I mean, the main, my quartet core is myself, Sam Walton, Eddie Spillett, Owen Gunnell. You know, we're thick as thieves, but as people, we're very different.
Yeah.
But we've got the same ideals, and as players, we have a lot in common. And so the group came about because of an opportunity originally to curate a concert of Steve Reich's music for the BBC Proms for the composer's 70th birthday, 2006. And I immediately turned to drumming because it was the piece that I felt I understood the least of his and wanted to know more about. So I programmed it and really caught the bug just with that one initial performance. And I thought, well, maybe we can keep this rolling. So decided to use that as a springboard to found this ensemble. And I've had a lot of support, actually. I must thank my agent, especially, for setting the group up, which certainly initially was very tough. And, you know, it wasn't much in it for them, because the concerts were, you know, a lot of work for them and not huge fees coming in. But I'm very happy that we're now up and running. And Steve got to know our work quite early on. Met him first in 2011, and he agreed to write a new piece for the group, which we premiered in 2014. And that's the quartet, for two vibraphones, two pianos. And it's born also of love of his music. As a percussionist, it's kind of a go-to, this music. But it also, it's music that does so well. Every time you revisit it, something else happens, and ideas are always emerging. And I'm fascinated by the music, and getting to know him, it's been a real honor, and I treasure it. You know, just been amazing. The other chamber projects I have, I mean, I've done a lot of things. I've worked very closely with string quartets, which I think has taught me a lot about many things. Too long to detail here, but working with string and instrumentalists closely is fascinating. I've had a long-standing project with the Miro Quartet, also the Pavel Haas Quartet over here in Europe, and more recently I've started working with the Jack Quartet.
Cool.
Who are just amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, wow, those guys, eh? Really,
yes.
Really good stuff.
So good.
So that's, I'm really trying to hold on to that, and we're trying to work out what we're going to do next. My closest association is in terms of a duo, would probably be my partnership with Håkan Hardenberger, mm-hmm. Swedish trumpet soloist, who's been just a great pal, a mentor, certainly, great guidance, and just someone to be really close with, and again, learning so much from working with a brass player of that quality has just been... Yeah, really, really, really powerful impression on me, I can tell you.
What have been some of your favorite pieces that you've played? Because I can only think of the two trumpet duos I can think of are the Nebojša Živković and the Andy Aquino duos.
This duo with trumpet? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's the big kind of blockbusting, although it's a very sort of bizarre piece, is the André Jolivet piece from 1971, Habitat, which is a large seven-movement work, extremely challenging and very difficult piece, certainly to pull off. The individual parts are difficult, and then to fuse it, to make it into a piece is complicated. But it's brilliant when it works. So that was the sort of initial work that, well, we've got to do the Jolivet. Hawkins is a big fan of Jolivet, interesting composer, writes very well for the trumpet, and also a composer with a percussion pedigree with that, you know, very interesting percussion concerto as well. And then we thought, well, that's one thing, you know, we need our own pieces. So since then, we've just been giving premieres, and we've given several. And we made an album this year on my record label, and that shows some of these premieres, notably a brand new piece from Brett Dean, which is for drum sets and trumpets. Joe Dedell, my man, beautiful piece for marimba and trumpet, flugel. Tobias Brostrom, who's another big sort of friend of percussion, with an excellent background, just this glorious piece, Dream Variations, which is sort of one-man gamelan orchestra and solo trumpet. And it's a bit like a trumpet concerto with a gamelan orchestra that you have to play yourself as a percussionist. Yeah, and it's great stuff. I mean, not easy, and it's fair enough doing it with the beast like Orkan, but you need a player in shape for this music, I'll tell you. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. So that record is one of two that has recently come out on your new record label, Colin Curry Records. And the other one is drumming, right?
Yeah, that's
so
it, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to create your own record label and you know, what you hope that to become?
Yeah, well, this is the latest ruse, is this record label. And it's called Colin Curry Records. Or you could say Colin Curry Records, because that's what I'll be doing on it. I'll be recording
a year and from.
So this year has been an exciting year because we launched our first album, which was crowdfunded. So thank you to anyone listening who did donate. And there's a lot of people out there. Actually, you were talking about Jennifer Higdon earlier. She reached out for this project amongst lots of other people. So
awesome.
Thank you, Jennifer. That we recorded in May. In May 2017, and we recorded it in one day, about 30 takes, and we have wonderful sound man, Ian Dearden. He produced it for us, and the thing was, we made the recording, we didn't quite know how it was going to go, but we thought we'd try and tout it around some of the majors. I won't mention any names, of course, but no one took us up on our offer, and so our consultant, our sort of... well, he's called Andy Doe, and he has become my sort of consultant in this label. He said, well, we can probably get you up and running via a channel that I've been working with, and that's the London Symphony Orchestra. So the LSO have their own label. It's called LSO Live, and it's a brilliant distribution thing. They've got all the channels open, you know, Spotify, Apple Music, CDs, even some vinyl being made, etc. And they've made labels for a couple of other people, the Marinsky Theatre with Gergiev, and also King's College Choir. And so they were asked if they would consider something similar for me and my projects, and they said yes. So it's all done via the LSO, and out my material goes. And it's a blessing for me, and it makes me sort of smack my lips and rub my hands, because I can record or release whatever I deem appropriate. So I can be quite ambitious with this thing, and certainly intend to be. The next projects, I mean, I'm not quite sure how they're going to land, but so I can't give details as such, but there's certainly going to be some more chamber projects released. We're going to do some more of Steve Reich's music. I think that's going to be one of the main themes, is to record Steve's music and have our own Steve tradition. And currently looking into my archive, because I've got, you know, dozens of concerto performances from broadcasts from, you know, at least a couple of decades, and some of them, if the quality is right, will also be released. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's kind of yeah, it's a big project. Again, it's a lot of manpower and a lot of support. And so
that's awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what, you know, what other records you put out. That's really awesome. It seems like a natural next step, actually, a natural next project, you know, sort of. So one thing that we haven't talked about yet, I guess, is your teaching. I know you do lots of master classes around the world when you're traveling for these concertos, and also teaching at Royal College of Music a little bit. And
Royal Academy.
Royal Academy.
Royal Academy, yeah.
Royal
yeah.
Academy. And then I met you this summer at Chosen Bale in New Hampshire. So can you just tell us a little bit about your teaching and how that kind of fits into your pie?
Well, I was extremely lucky because I had brilliant teachers, especially my teenage years. I was very, very close with my percussion teacher, Pamela Dow, and my piano teacher, Sheila Dessen. This is where I grew up in Scotland. And my parents, in different ways and at different points in their careers, have also been teachers. So I think there's a lot of backgrounds there, and some kind of tradition of trying to pass things on. And I certainly benefited enormously. I mean, would never have had my eyes opened had it not been for these teachers. And actually, when I studied in London at Royal Academy of Music, with a lot of help from Neil Percy, principal percussion of LSO, etc. And great guidance. You know, I mentioned already Håkan, kind of mentor for me. So these things are very important. And I don't know if I'm a good teacher, but I want to at least try. And if people can relate to what I'm saying and how I'm saying it, then that's good. And so normally when I'm asked to give a masterclass, I take the opportunity, and frequently visiting orchestras, there will be an opportunity to give a class. And Royal Academy of Music is a great place to be based as a teacher. I mean, I'm visiting professor there, so it's not an enormous amount of time, but everyone gets lessons with me once a term.
Cool.
And I help them build their recitals. And it's a big variety of interests in my area. I mean, some of them are really into this stuff, and others just need it so that they can get their chops together for an audition, or just want to get a bit of familiarity with marimba and technique and things. So I'm just there to try and sort of just help people and as best I can. So yeah, I mean, I do enjoy it. I wish there was more time for it. I mean, the 6 days of the academy can be a push, but I like to be there for students and try and help young players. And they make me think. You know, they ask me questions. I think, wow, God, I never thought about that. How do I answer? And I always try and give them an answer. But still looking for it sometimes myself.
Cool. That's awesome. Well, I think we've covered it. I have a very light question from a Facebook question that just came in that maybe we can just use to wrap this up here. But Reed Puleo wants to know, what is your favorite TV show?
Well, if he's asking, it's definitely Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Well, Colin, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a delightful hour learning more about you and what you do and your upcoming projects. And it's just been really fun to chat with you. So thank you for joining us.
Very welcome. And good on this podcast. I wish you lots of success and continued episodes. Fantastic.
Thank